welcome to the podcast for TheForce.net. My name's Eric, and I'm your host, bringing you the latest news, commentary, and events from the Star Wars community. Well, we finally made it. The circle is now complete. Revenge of the Sith has hit theaters, and by now, most of you have seen it. Obviously, this is going to change the spoiler policy that we have here on the podcast. So before we go any further, let me clarify things a bit. I'm going to be talking about things from the movie from now on, and many of these will be spoilers, but just as a courtesy, I'll still give the spoiler warnings for 1 week from the release date. You can consider that a general rule of thumb for all Star Wars content here on the podcast. Anytime a novel or a video game, a comic book issue, a television episode, or anything like that is released, I'll give it 1 week in which I'll give spoiler warnings. After that, it's fair game. So, here's your warning. In today's episode, I give my analysis and review of Episode 3, and it does contain spoilers. If you still haven't seen the movie yet, save this file until you have, then come back and listen to it. This is your last warning. This episode has spoilers. Episode 3 has already been breaking records, which really is no big surprise. It screened in 2,900 theaters at midnight on Wednesday, though I'm not sure in how many actual screens, and the updated figures show that just the midnight shows alone brought in $16.9 million. It brought in $50 million on Thursday alone, breaking the best opening day record, previously held by Spider-Man 2, at $40.4 million, and the best single-day record, held by Shrek 2, at $44.8 million. I've got a chart on my personal website at randomchatter.com, where I'll be tracking the various box office records, showing who currently holds them, and how Episodes 1 and 2 did by comparison. Here's the quick rundown. In their opening weekends, Episode 1 brought in about $64 million, and Episode 2 brought in about $80 million. The record is held by the first Spider-Man movie at $114.8 million. In their second weekend, Episode 1 brought in $51 million, and Episode 2 brought in even less at $48 million. The current record holder is Shrek 2 at $72 million. Reaching the $100 million mark took Episode 1 5 days, and Episode 2 only 4 days. The record is currently tied between Spider-Man 2 and The Matrix Reloaded at 3 days. It took Episode 1 13 days to reach $200 million, and Episode 2 squeaked in a day earlier at 12 days. Spider-Man 2 took only 8 days. Episode 1 hit the $300 million mark in 28 days, but it took Episode 2 104 days. Shrek 2 made it in only 18. Only 4 films have ever hit the $400 million mark, 6 if you want to include the re-releases of A New Hope and E.T. Shrek 2 leads the list at 43 days, and Phantom Menace pulls in 4th place at 67 days. As far as the overall domestic and international box office sales, which are really the numbers everybody cares about, Titanic is the one to beat. Domestically, it made $600 million, and outside the U.S., it made $1.2 billion, more than doubling Phantom Menace. Like I said, I'll be maintaining the list on my site at randomchatter.com, though you're more likely to catch the news first on TheForce.net. I'm going to give you my initial thoughts on Episode 3, even though they might change a little bit after I've seen it a few more times. Just so you know where I'm coming from, I've read the novel and the comic book. I didn't read the screenplay, but I knew a lot about the movie going in. I'm going to first cover the things I didn't like, then I'm going to get to the things I did like. That way I'm ending the review on a positive note. There were some really, really good things in this film, and there were some really, really bad things. Fortunately, I feel most of the good compensated for most of the bad, but the bad is still worth mentioning. Before I can get excited about all the good things in the film, I've got to rant a little bit and get some things off my chest. We might as well start with the biggest problem. I've said it a million times, George Lucas is a gifted filmmaker, and I love the overall story and mythos he's created for Star Wars. He really is very talented. Directing and writing dialogue, however, are not ways in which he's very talented. Fortunately, by this point in the prequel saga, most of the actors were able to work around the bad dialogue. Not always, though, and the two cases in which this was most obvious were the battle droids at the beginning of the movie, and almost any scene with Padme and Anakin. comedy in the original trilogy came easily, mostly thanks to the Han Solo character. But there wasn't a Han character in the prequel trilogy, and that hurt the prequels in many ways, I think. In Episode 1, we had Jar Jar and slapstick-style comedy. I'm not sure a bumbling oaf was the best comedy choice, but that's what we got. And he also appealed to the kids, so he actually did serve a legitimate purpose. And the slapstick during the fight between the Gungans and the battle droids really wasn't all that bad, since it kind of carried the tone of the battle. The problem was, we were already sick of them by then. But what was even worse than Jar Jar, at least in my opinion, were C-3PO's wisecracks in Episode 2. "This is such a drag, and I'm beside myself." Those are two lines that never should have made it into any Star Wars film. The talking battle droids at the beginning of the movie were awful. Lucas seemed to have gotten other humorous moments right throughout the movie, including R2-D2 and a few lines here or there by Obi-Wan, but the battle droids were just plain awful. As for Anakin and Padme, Lucas should never be allowed to write anything romantic again. I can't tell you how glad I am that he didn't direct Empire Strikes Back. You know that whole "I love you, I know" thing that Leia and Han have? Lucas hated that, yet everybody else loves it, and Lucas doesn't get why. And frankly, I think that explains a lot about why the interaction between Anakin and Padme has felt so superficial in the last two films. But this problem goes even beyond the dialogue. The mechanism that drove this movie was the concept of relationships. The relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan, Anakin and Palpatine, Anakin and the Jedi Council, Anakin and Padme. And all of those worked for me except that last one. His obsession with Padme was the reason Anakin turned to the dark side. He couldn't bear the thought of losing her. Knowing that is enough for me. The fact that Padme was insignificant in this film is acceptable. Barely, but it's acceptable. It's enough to know that she's his motivation for everything he does. But Lucas doesn't show this. We get a really good scene between them after he arrives back on Coruscant. Things seem to be going really well. You can tell that they really love each other and that there's a strong bond there. Then, in their next scene, she's on a balcony brushing her hair, and he's like 20 feet away from her, standing in the doorway watching her. Huh? Why isn't he all over her? I suppose someone could argue that there was something romantic about that scene. Maybe in concept, but it certainly wasn't portrayed as romantic. It was portrayed in such a way that they almost seemed awkward around each other. And as a friend of mine pointed out, the hug at the end of that scene was awful. Padme says something along the lines of, "Hold me, Anakin. Hold me like you did back on Naboo, where there were no politics, no battles, no war." And it just doesn't work. In Return of the Jedi, Leia throws herself at Han and simply says, "Hold me." And it works. Show us what's going on. Don't tell us. Aside from her interaction with Anakin, Padme really fell flat in this movie, and it wasn't Natalie Portman's fault. Lucas made her into the stereotypical housewife, barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. Well, I guess she had C-3PO for kitchen duty, but I mean still, she was totally insignificant. I'm going to come back to this point in a moment. For now, I'm going to go off on a tangent. Kashyyyk, which I habitually mispronounce, was almost worthless. The scenes looked beautiful, but they only really served two purposes. One was to get Chewbacca in the movie, and the other was to get Yoda off of Coruscant. And for someone who trims their films to get them 99% fat-free, I don't get why Lucas didn't cut these scenes. I guess he thought he needed an action sequence right there or something. Personally, I thought there were plenty of action scenes in the movie already. I think Kashyyyk should have been cut. Sure, it was a good-looking sequence, but as much as I really like Chewbacca, why bother giving him a cameo just for the sake of doing so? Have him do something important, or keep him out of the way. There's just too much going on elsewhere in this film. Here's why I went off on that tangent. Originally, Padme had a few scenes where she, along with several other senators, including Bail Organa and Mon Mothma, presents a petition to Palpatine to basically address the ridiculous amount of power he's acquired throughout the war efforts. Rather than having included Kashyyyk, I think Lucas should have put the petition scenes in the film instead. We're used to Padme being a very powerful character who gets things done. Instead, in this film, she sits in her apartment for the entire movie and mopes. The petition scenes would have shown that she's still very active, still a very strong character, and in addition, it would have explained some of the tension between the differences in opinion that she and Anakin have regarding politics and supporting Palpatine. It also would have demonstrated the extent to which Anakin is really torn between supporting Palpatine versus supporting everyone else around him. It doesn't have to explain the decision he makes later, it just has to explain the amount of tension he has surrounding the issue and why his judgment's so clouded. Wrapping things up here with Padme, I thought the circumstances surrounding her death were silly. Everything made perfect sense up until the medical droid opened its mouth, so to speak. As soon as he said they could find nothing physically wrong with her and that she died of a broken heart, a scene that made perfect sense no longer makes any sense at all. The force choke Anakin gave her should have been a little bit longer, I think, to get the full effect, but regardless, he choked her enough to render her unconscious. We all know the effects long-term stress can have on somebody's body, and she's definitely been under long-term stress. Her husband's been on the front lines in a galactic war, she has to hide her marriage, she has to hide her pregnancy, and the Republic is turning into a dictatorship. Add to that the short-term emotional trauma of learning her husband slaughtered Jedi, including children, and that now he's turning on her, that's enough to really put somebody through the ringer. And then for him to choke her like that, it's not surprising that a woman would have some complications in childbirth. But to write the entire thing off as if there's nothing physically wrong with her at all, that just seemed a little bit weak to me. For the most part, everything dealing with Emperor Palpatine was good. However, there were a few issues I had. Reading the book, his ability to kill the three Jedi during the arrest scene made sense. In the movie, you could hardly tell specifically what was going on with the lightsabers or how he actually hit any of them, and it made no sense. Also, it wasn't really clear whether Mace actually did beat him or whether he was just putting on a show for Anakin. After he kills Mace, he sure stands up well enough with no signs of physical exhaustion. And even before that, when Mace lifts his lightsaber up over his head for the final strike, that would have been the perfect time for Force Lightning. Given all of Palpatine's manipulations so far, I'm curious as to whether he let Mace win. I know a lot of people really liked the fight between Yoda and Palpatine, but I found it pretty boring. When Yoda pulled out a lightsaber on Count Dooku in Episode 2, it was cool, partially because we didn't know Yoda could do something like that. When he and Palpatine go at it, it's merely okay. But then when they move into the Senate chamber, the fight really lost interest to me. The duel between Anakin and Obi-Wan was intense, and there was a lot of emotional drama and conflict going on there. Not so with the Yoda-Palpatine fight. You've got some guy laughing like a maniac, telekinetically throwing things at Yoda. Then you cut to what's arguably the best lightsaber battle of the entire saga. Then you cut back to the laughing maniac throwing chairs again. Sure, if you think about it, I'm sure you could explain why there was emotional drama in the Yoda-Palpatine fight too. But plot threads are something you think about. Emotional moments are something you're supposed to feel, and I just didn't feel anything during that fight. I was hoping for a climax closer to that of Return of the Jedi, and when you think about it, the prequel closest to that is really Phantom Menace. Think about it, you've got starfighters attacking a seemingly impervious capital ship, you've got Gungans losing to an army of droids, you've got two Jedi barely holding their own against a Sith Lord, and the Queen gets captured while infiltrating the palace. Just like in Jedi, where you've got the Endor team captured, the space fleet unable to get the shields down on the Death Star, and Luke about to lose to Vader and the Emperor. You don't know what's going to happen, and there's a very strong intensity level there. In this case, you've got Anakin versus Obi-Wan, and Yoda versus Palpatine. And you already know what happens. Yoda and Palpatine will both walk away. So will Obi-Wan, and Anakin will get burned up but eventually rescued. So it's not a matter of what happens, but how it happens. And while they still managed to keep the Mustafar battle fairly intense, I think they lost it on the Yoda-Palpatine fight. That being said, I'll concede that the fight was visually impressive. Another visually impressive fight was between Obi-Wan and General Grievous. My only complaint there was that the lightsaber fight was too short. And that's a rather backhanded complaint, because really it's General Grievous's coolness that makes me want to see more of him. The only real issue I had with Grievous is that his coughing was never explained in the movie. Sure, it's explained in the Clone Wars cartoon, but most people who see the film will not have seen the cartoon, considering all the casual fans and moviegoers out there. And you can't leave something like this in the film and not explain it, especially when you've got a robot coughing. Robots don't cough. And before you guys start sending me emails explaining that he's a cyborg and not really a robot, I already know that. My point is that many people don't know that, and I've already had to explain to people why the robot guy is coughing. And that was before the movie was even released. I really wish it had been just a little bit more clear for the sake of the more casual fans out there. One visual effect that did not work was Jango Fett's head on the clone troopers. There were many scenes where it was painfully obvious that the head was real but the body was CG, and the sync between the motions of the head did not match the body. If a B-grade movie like Kung Pao can pull it off, you'd think that ILM could somehow find a better way to do it. I was actually surprised at how bad it looked. Fortunately, it never really mattered much. I was kind of disappointed that they didn't show Yoda going to Dagobah, and I was really disappointed in how they dealt with the issue of Qui-Gon. Even if they didn't have his ghost appear, they should have at least had his voice. There should have been something more there. Finally, the most disappointing, almost embarrassing part of the movie was Darth Vader screaming no at the end of the film. I really want to know who green-lighted that audio take. Did Lucas even hear it? I mean, come on, that was beyond pathetic. As was whatever that was he was doing with his arms. The whole scene looked fine up until that moment. Overall, I think the most important failings of the movie boiled down to the fact that Anakin and Padme scenes just didn't work, and that Padme fell flat in general. And unlike in the first two films, where it seemed like Lucas had 15 minutes of story and tried to spread it out into 2 hours, this time around, it seemed like he had 4 hours of story and tried to trim it down into 2.5 hours. I really think that hurt the movie overall, and I really wish that Lucas would get the hint from Peter Jackson that people actually will sit down for a 4-hour-long movie on DVD, where they can pause it or spread it out over 2 nights. Sure, that might not work in the theater, but for the film's DVD release, I'd love to see an extended 4-hour version. Unfortunately, I know that's never going to happen. Okay, now the good stuff. I'd seen much of the opening cut previously, but this is the first time I saw the entire shot. Everything about the space battle was awesome. After seeing that, I really want a Rogue Squadron television series. And despite the goofiness of the battle droids, I actually liked R2 on Grievous' ship, the Invisible Hand. And the fight with Dooku was much better this time around. I think it was just the right length, and the level of action was far better than it was in Episode 2. Really, I enjoyed the entire segment aboard the Invisible Hand. It was nice to see Anakin and Obi-Wan working well as a team, and really, this is the first time we've gotten a chance to see it. The only times they were together in Episode 2 were in the Coruscant chase scene and the arena scene, and in both scenes they were working fairly independently. Here, for the first time, we see them working as a well-oiled machine. Despite my earlier complaints, Anakin and Padme did have 2 good scenes together. The first was the scene where Anakin arrives back on Coruscant. Christensen and Portman manage to work past the bad dialogue and deliver an interesting, believable scene. And the same goes for their scene on Mustafar. They manage to work past some very poorly written lines and make them believable. And Portman did a very good job during her short scene in the Senate. I liked everything that happened on Utapau. As I said earlier, I wish the lightsaber battle between Obi-Wan and Grievous had gone on a little bit longer, but what we did get to see was excellent. And I was really worried about how Obi-Wan was going to look on the lizard. Turns out they pulled it off quite well, much better than in similar scenes in Episode 2. I thought Palpatine's physical transformation was handled very well, even if I'm not sure how I feel about the fight scene in general. And while I didn't care much about the fight between him and Yoda, I thought it was well done. The final duel was great. That was a difficult thing to pull off, since we all know how it ends ahead of time. So I find it even more impressive that Lucas was able to write and direct it in such a way that it was still able to give it an epic, intense feel. I think that covers most of the specific scenes. Moving on to more general stuff, the film really did look stunning. I found there were fewer visual distractions in this film than in the others. By that I'm referring to things such as most of the Mos Eisley edition in the special edition of A New Hope. Things that are there merely for us to look at, and that aren't really part of an establishing shot or a scene transition. I found there was much less of that in Episode 3. I really like the ship designs. I love the new Jedi fighters that Anakin and Obi-Wan had, and I love the new clone trooper ships that are the predecessors to the X-Wings. The capital ships look great, and even most of the shuttles look kinda cool. The environments were just incredible. The models for Utapau, Kashyyyk, and Mustafar were absolutely spectacular, and the model shop over at ILM deserves congratulations. I don't have the names of all the other planets down quite yet, but even the planets we saw very little of looked great. The interior locations looked really good as well. Not only did Coruscant look even better than it has in the past, it was also nice to see the interior of the Tanif IV as kind of a throwback to the original trilogy. The aliens looked really good in this film too. Yes, you could tell they were CG, but they seemed to work better. And the conceptual designs for the aliens were really good, too. Perhaps the most pleasant surprise for me was that most of the relationships worked so well. As I said earlier, while the themes of the movie may have been betrayal, loss, arrogance, things like that, the vehicle that pushed the movie forward was the relationships. There were two relationships that were critical to the film, and two that didn't matter quite as much. Fortunately, three of those four worked out very well, and given that the fourth had improved since the last film, I found it easy to overlook. The two critical relationships were those of Anakin and Obi-Wan, and of Anakin and Palpatine. I remember watching Episode 2 for the first time and feeling like the interaction between Obi-Wan and Anakin in the elevator up to Padme's apartment seemed really forced. In this film, it was about as smooth as it could be. It worked smoothly in the beginning with them as friends, and it even worked smoothly at the end with them as enemies. Everything about the interaction between the two of them was near flawless. Ian McDiarmid stole the show as Palpatine, and the relationship between him and Anakin was completely believable. Most of the movie rested upon their scenes, and had the scenes not worked, the movie would have failed. I honestly believe Hayden Christensen is a far better actor than he's been allowed to show in the Star Wars films, but I think that in most of these scenes, it was really Ian McDiarmid who carried the weight. And appropriately so. We had to believe that Palpatine was actually someone who could manipulate Anakin and steer him down the path to the dark side slowly and subtly, so that Anakin didn't realize he was being manipulated, and so that when the time came, Anakin would be absolutely unable to say no. Overall, the acting in this movie was much better than in the last two prequels, and the only time it really failed was when the dialogue was especially bad, and those scenes were between Anakin and Padme. As I said earlier, Lucas can't write romance. But fortunately, while this relationship was critical to Episode 2, it didn't matter as much here. What matters is that we knew Anakin was obsessed with protecting Padme, and that came across despite the awkward moments between the two of them. The other relationship that didn't matter quite as much was that of Anakin and the Jedi Council in general. I think it made a lot more sense in the book, but I think enough of it came through in the film as to show the rift growing between Anakin and the Council. While not quite as clear as I'd have liked it to be, I think the relationship played out fairly well. Those are my initial thoughts after the first viewing. This movie is crammed with content, perhaps too much so. And I think it'll probably take a few more viewings for me to really settle on a firm opinion. But to sum things up, I liked the movie. I really liked it, especially compared to the other prequels. I hated Episode 1, but I kinda liked Episode 2. But this is better than both of those put together. As for how I'd rank it, I still think Empire Strikes Back is the best, followed by A New Hope. But Revenge of the Sith has a solid spot in third place. It was definitely better than Return of the Jedi. In fact, the only reason I put A New Hope above it is that A New Hope works better as an individual film, and it's a more epic mythological story. That's what pushes it over the top for me. If I were to look closely at each of the films and pick apart the various acts or scenes, rather than observing them each as a whole, it's quite possible I'd put Revenge of the Sith in second place. But as a complete film, I don't think it's quite there. I knew that I wanted more things out of Episode 3 than could be put in a 2.5-hour-long film, and so that being said, I'm very satisfied with it. I think it was a good wrap-up to the prequel trilogy and a fitting end to the story of Anakin Skywalker as he once was. And though I know many fans are thinking I can't believe it's all over, it's not over for me. For starters, I'll see the film several more times in the theater, and then the DVD will be out before Christmas and it'll have new content. I've got many books I've still got to catch up on from the prequel era alone, and there are still more coming out. And there are a bunch of comics I've got to go back and read, too. So Star Wars still moves on for me. And yeah, I know it's different with the films, but I don't care as much about new content with the films. What I care about is that when I go back and watch the old content for the 100th time, that it moves me the same way it did when I'd only seen it a couple of times. And in that way, I believe Revenge of the Sith is a great success, and my enjoyment of it is just beginning. I really hope you guys enjoyed the review, and if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at podcast@theforce.net. As always, remember that the opinions expressed here are my own, and do not reflect those of other TFN staff members, nor of Lucasfilm. Theforce.net is not affiliated with Lucasfilm in any way. Until next time, take care, and may the Force be with you.